Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. Today I'm your host, Bob McChesney, February 26, 2006, here in WILL AM 580 in truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this lovely, lovely February Sunday afternoon. Bright blue skies and sunny. Can't see it from our studio in here, but I know it's out there because I just walked through it. We have a show that many of you have been waiting for in our listening audience for a long time. Much promised, much ballyhooed. It will be today. Our guest, Noam Chomsky, live on the phones with us from his home in Lexington, Massachusetts, ready to take your calls and talk about the state of the world and the state of the media today. So please get ready to call in, get ready to listen to Professor Noam Chomsky. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Two new bills introduced in the Senate have enormous potential to dramatically expand the availability of wireless broadband access throughout the United States. The legislation would direct the FCC to recycle open channels on the analog TV spectrum for unlicensed wireless broadband use. J.H. Snyder, research director of the Wireless Future Program at the New America Foundation, says analog TV spectrum is especially useful for this purpose.
The most valuable spectrum for broadband is low frequency spectrum because it can penetrate walls, trees, and other obstacles.
The FCC's rules don't allow television stations to occupy every available channel in every available market. These unused channels, which are commonly called white spaces in regulatory lingo, represent a lot of valuable spectrum that is essentially going to waste.
Our studies indicate that between 10 and 40 channels in a given TV market are lying fallow. They're guard band space, basically, that's no longer needed.
Unlicensed use of this spectrum would lower the financial barriers to entry for wireless internet service providers and could be extremely helpful in providing rural areas with connectivity, areas where broadband cable or DSL service is unavailable. In short, recycling analog TV spectrum for wireless broadband represents the most realistic possibility to achieve universal and affordable broadband access nationwide. Television broadcasters are in the midst of transitioning from analog to digital, which uses an entirely different area of the electromagnetic spectrum than analog broadcasts do. However, Snyder says the powerful broadcast lobby is pressuring the FCC to let TV stations keep the analog spectrum and use it to increase their digital coverage areas.
Currently, broadcasters have basically a single tower, serves maybe 1,000 square miles. And now they would have the right to put towers on, you know, every light post.
The FCC's own rulemaking on using analog TV spectrum for wireless broadband has been dormant for more than a year now, which may explain the senatorial nudge. If either bill becomes law, it would force the FCC to open up the spectrum for wireless broadband within 6 months.
Government propaganda, both foreign and domestic, is back in the news again. The Government Accountability Office recently released a study of contracts for media production and placement involving seven federal cabinet-level departments. The report cataloged more than $1.6 billion in expenditures on media contracts between 2003 and the first half of 2005. However, the GAO figure should be considered conservatively, as the agency studied in its report voluntarily provided the spending numbers, which were not independently verified, and very few details were given about how the money was actually spent. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld reversed himself over a claim that a controversial project involving paying Iraqi newspapers to publish stories ghostwritten by U.S. troops had been discontinued. The military says it's conducted a review of the project, but its results have not been made public. At a recent speech to the Council on Foreign Relations, Rumsfeld claimed the propaganda battle has no geographic boundaries.
In this war, some of the most critical battles may not be fought in the mountains of Afghanistan or the streets of Baghdad, but in the newsrooms in places like New York and London and Cairo and elsewhere.
Rumsfeld also believes the solution to the propaganda problem is more, not less of it.
That will require instituting 24-hour press operation centers, elevating internet operations and other channels of communication to equal status with the traditional 20th century press relations. Our U.S. Central Command, for example, has launched an online communications effort that includes electronic news updates and a links campaign that has resulted in several hundred blogs receiving and publishing CENTCOM content.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has also requested some $75 million in emergency funding for propaganda operations targeting Iran. That's a sevenfold increase over what's currently spent there.
Back in the homeland, a Minnesota television station has refused a commercial sponsored by the Progress for America Voter Fund, an advocacy group with strong ties to the Bush White House. The spot supposedly features parents of soldiers from the Midwest invoking the horrors of 9/11 as a reason for the American people to stay the course in Iraq. But it turns out that many of those in the ad are not really from the Midwest, and one of those portrayed as a fallen soldier's mother is actually his stepmom. The dead man's biological mother actually believes he died for a lie. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 on this beautiful Sunday, February 26, 2006. Today we have a guest I've been looking forward to for a very long time, someone who's been on the show before. Someone who I think for many people needs no introduction at all, but for some may well. So it's worth pointing out that our guest today, Noam Chomsky, is the Institute Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He is credited with the creation of the theory of generative grammar, often considered the most significant contribution to the field of theoretical linguistics of the 20th century, and one of the most prominent intellectuals in the world today. Noam Chomsky is also prominent as an incisive political analyst, as a political intellectual, as a figure who has strongly influenced many people, including yours truly. I think it's safe to say that no single scholar has had more influence upon my political, intellectual, and even moral development than our guest today, Noam Chomsky. It is an honor to welcome him. Noam, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks very much for that, Bob.
Well, it's true words have never been said. Noam, it's an honor to have you here with us on the air at WILL. So you've been on the show, I think the last time was a couple of years ago, and I don't think we've spoken to since then. And obviously a lot has gone on in the world, and I think the place to start, if we can, is to talk, if you can give me your assessment of, you know, the Iraq War, the invasion and occupation by the United States. You know, what has happened there and what, you know, what it means in your side? What does it mean for the U.S. role in the world in the years coming ahead? What does it mean for politics in this country and around the world? I mean, what is the implications of what's going on in Iraq for the world?
Well, it's an event of enormous significance, obviously. Just one word about media coverage. And then I'll stop on that, unless you want to go back to it.
You can talk about media all you want on this show.
Well, yeah, I realize. The media coverage has been extremely interesting. It's you can find critical media coverage, but what's interesting is the general framework, as always. The media coverage, almost 100% that I've seen, for example, everything I hear on NPR, say, or read in the New York Times, is at the level of a high school newspaper cheering the local football team. The only questions do come up, critical questions too. For example, how are we doing? Could we do better if we tried another way? Should we get a different coach? You know, put in a different player or something like that. But the question whether it's legitimate to be there and to win, that's unimaginable. Just like a high school football newspaper. I mean, you read, say, this morning's New York Times book review. A good reporter, Dexter Filkins, reviewing, he's done good work there, reviewing Paul Bremer's book. And, you know, he praises some parts of it. He says his very welcome proposal to bring in another 40,000 troops, that would have been a great idea, but unfortunately Washington wouldn't let him do it, and there's some bad things. You know, I didn't do enough to establish the U.S. goal of bringing democracy and sovereignty to Iraq. But that's all. I mean, the idea that that's the goal is about as plausible as the belief that that was Germany's goal in France or something. But since our dear leader says it, it has to be true, no matter what the evidence is. And since we did it, it's got to be right. Well, if you go back to what, and that's just about uniform. And within that framework, you can't have a sensible discussion, plainly. As for what it means, it's quite clear. This is a major war crime. It's what the Nuremberg Tribunal called the supreme international crime, the invasion, that is. Supreme international crime, which encompasses all the evil that follows. And all the evil that follows means all the evil, like Abu Ghraib and Fallujah and blowing up the Samarra Mosque and so on. Yeah, that's the evil that follows aggression, the supreme international crime. And then come a whole series of individual war crimes, like, for example, the attack on Fallujah in November 2004. It was publicly described with pride as a major war crime. So, for example, I happened to be in New York giving talks while it was going on. My talks just used that morning's New York Times. Big picture on the front page about how the first great achievement was to take over the General Hospital in Fallujah and force the patients onto the floor and the doctors with their hands tied behind them. It was justified by the fact that the hospital was a propaganda center. It was releasing casualty figures. I mean, just take a look at the Geneva Conventions. That's a grave breach of the conventions. Under U.S. law, U.S. War Crimes Act, every top leader is not only subject to a trial, but in fact the death penalty. That's the penalty for grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. Does it matter? No. We're doing it, so it must be right. Only problem is, does it work or does it cost too much? The consequences for Iraq are a total disaster. I mean, the country had already been devastated by 10 years of sanctions, which had virtually destroyed the civilian society, had strengthened the tyrant, had forced the population to rely on him for survival, and probably saved him from being sent the same way as a long series of other gangsters supported by the U.S. and Britain until the very end, Suharto, Ceausescu, a whole bunch of others. And that's exactly why Iraqi dissidents were calling for pleading for relaxation of the sanctions so that society could be reconstructed and they could take care of their affairs, including getting rid of the tyrant. But the U.S. wouldn't allow that. We've got to do it our way for our purposes. And our purposes are to prevent the threat of a democratic, sovereign Iraq, which would be an utter nightmare for U.S. planners. They've been doing everything they can to prevent it, and will surely continue. As for Iraq itself, it's catastrophic. The sanctions were awful enough. What's happened since is worse. Simply look at the official statistics and people's lives. As for the world, well, it has very serious implications. For one thing, tearing to shreds the framework, the basic framework of international law, including international humanitarian law, that's serious. I mean, that's a thin thread on which survival rests. And just tearing it to shreds weakens that thread, plainly. Furthermore, there are narrower and anticipated consequences. It was anticipated, warnings from intelligence agencies, analysts, and so on, that the invasion would very likely increase the threat of terror and the threat of nuclear proliferation. Well, the same agencies now confirm that that's exactly what happened, in fact, to a degree that was unanticipated. Nobody could have anticipated some of the escalation of the threat of terror, which is very severe, and nuclear proliferation, which is worse. Amazingly, to me at least, to anybody who's followed it, the U.S. was unable to carry out the conquest. And this should have been one of the easiest military victories in history. The country was virtually destroyed already. It was being held together with Scotch tape. There had no significant military forces. In fact, the U.S. and Britain had been, we now know, had been secretly bombing for about a year to ensure that there could be no air defenses and others, and had also been bribing top Iraqi generals, which wasn't very hard because who wanted to resist a total disaster. So they could have, the natural assumption is they'll just walk in. They're eliminating two brutal regimes, One we're allowed to talk about, Saddam. The other we're not allowed to talk about, the sanctions, which were destroying the society. But both of those finally were gone. The U.S. could come in with enormous resources, should be able to rebuild some of the wreckage it created. It should have been a very easy military victory. Remarkably, the Washington planners are having far more trouble in Iraq than, say, the Germans had in occupied Europe. There were partisans, but they wouldn't have lasted very long if Germany hadn't been at war. And the countries of Europe were run by local people, civilian authorities, local security forces, and so on, with a German fist in the background. And that was in the midst of a terrible war. Or take, say, the Russian satellites in Eastern Europe. I mean, they were run by the local population, civilian authorities, civilian collaborators, security forces, police, armies, and so on. Again, Russian forces in the background if they're ever needed, but they weren't running the countries. If the U.S. has not been able to accomplish anything remotely like that. Right now, according to U.S. and British polls, about 80% of the population of all of Iraq, which means a much higher percentage in the Arab parts of Iraq, want the U.S. and British forces to leave. They want a strict timetable for withdrawal, and almost half approve of attacks on these forces. Well, there wasn't anything like that under... this is a military catastrophe of a kind that has few analogs, as has been pointed out by some of the serious journalists, like Patrick Coburn, for example. No, can't think of a military catastrophe like it, with its long experience and so on. Well, that's what the effects of that will be are pretty hard to say. I mean, one thing that, with all the talk about withdrawal plans and exit strategies and so on, it's important to remember that they really don't mean anything unless we face the fact that for the U.S., for U.S. planners, a sovereign, more or less democratic Iraq could be an ultimate nightmare, which is why they've done everything they could to block elections, to prevent sovereignty, and so on, because it just consider what the policies would be likely to be of a sovereign, more or less democratic Iraq, have a Shiite majority, therefore they'd be highly influential. The Shiite regions have to be where most of the oil is. They much prefer friendly relations with Iran than hostile relations. In fact, they already have close relations. Majority of the clerics either were born in Iran or have close connections with them. This includes Ayatollah Sistani, who comes from Iran. One of the main militias, two main militias that control the south, the Badr Brigades, was trained and armed in Iran. There have been official contacts up and back. They want to improve commercial and other relations. And sure, that's going to continue. So you will have a strong likelihood of a kind of a Shiite alliance of some sort, including Iraq, Shiite-dominated Iraq, and Iran, the last thing the U.S. wants. And it gets worse. Right across the border in Saudi Arabia, which happens to be where most of Saudi oil is, there's a population with a Shiite majority. They've been bitterly oppressed by the U.S.-backed tyranny and have repeatedly tried to get a little bit of justice and autonomy. And, of course, those forces are increasing as Iraq moves towards some limited form of sovereignty, and they're going to continue. Well, just think what you end up with. A loose Shiite alliance, independent of Washington, controlling the bulk of the world's energy resources. I mean, can you imagine a worse nightmare? Yeah, actually you can, and I'm sure they're thinking about it in the Pentagon. There's a strong possibility that to the extent that they gain some independence, and Iran already has independence, they will turn to the east. And there is a very significant, there are significant developments in Asia, including the development of an Asian energy security grid based primarily in China, along with Russia. India is vacillating. They may or may not join. South Korea will almost surely join, maybe Japan, Southeast Asian countries. They want to have the fastest growing region in the world. They want control of their own energy resources and an energy grid to distribute it and so on. Well, suppose Iran joins them, or suppose even worse from Washington's point of view, a Shiite-dominated region that's controlling the most of Middle East oil joins them. Well, it turns the U.S. into a second-class power. They're not going to do anything they can to prevent that. I mean, these are all issues that have to be faced when we talk about exit strategies. Sure, the occupying armies should be withdrawn, exactly as the population wants. But just put yourself in the shoes of Rumsfeld and Cheney and see what they're seeing. Those issues have to be confronted if we want to be serious about this.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Noam Chomsky, who you've been listening to. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live on WILL AM 580. We are going to take some phone calls for Noam Chomsky in a second. The phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And when we do go to the phone calls, I'd appreciate it if callers would be as brief as possible, because we have a lot of people who do want to call in. But before we get back to the phone lines, Noam, I do have a follow-up which deals with Iran, which you raised. We're hearing a lot about Iran and nuclear weapons and how we have to really take care of the Iran regime. What do you think is really going on here? I mean, you've been talking about Iran and oil and geopolitics. I mean, what is the U.S. concern with Iran? How legitimate or how real is the concern about nuclear weapons? And what is the actual possibility that the people running this country could want to have a war with Iran?
Well, first of all, you know, the world looks quite different to people who are holding a club and people who are being beaten by it. And we ought to be able to take a look at it from the point of view of those who are being beaten by it, the Iranians. The U.S. has been torturing Iran for 50 years, ever since the U.S. and Britain overthrew the parliamentary government and installed a brutal tyrant. And it continued to torture them right through the rule of the Shah, 1970 till 1979. And incidentally, during that period in the 1970s, it was encouraging and assisting the very nuclear development programs and uranium enrichment programs that it is now condemning. In fact, my own university, MIT, was involved in them with government support, probably initiative. Iranians know that. Well, they overthrew the U.S.-backed tyrant. That is impermissible, and they have to be punished for that. And they were. The U.S. immediately turned to, first of all, tried to overthrow the regime, couldn't carry off a military coup, though it tried. Then it supported Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran, which was a very brutal affair. hundreds of thousands of Iranians were killed. Saddam used chemical weapons with U.S. support and indeed assistance. That's a terrible event in their history. Right after that came the U.S. sanctions, which are designed to punish them for defying the master and for moving towards independence. And it continues right until today. All right, let's go to the nuclear issues. I mean, that's the history that they see. Happens to be an accurate one. Let's come to the last couple of years. A couple of years ago, the there is an issue, and there's a serious issue about Iranian uranium enrichment programs. What they're doing, as far as anyone knows, is completely legal. It's within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. However, the Bush administration has a point when it says that the Non-Proliferation Treaty has to be strengthened. There are two major articles in the treaty, Article 4 and Article 6, and that's kind of the bargain that was made between the nuclear and non-nuclear states. Article 4 says that the non-nuclear states have the right to carry out enrichment and other development programs to develop nuclear energy. That's Article 4. Article 6 says that the nuclear states must make good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons. Now, that is, in fact, a legal obligation, as determined by the World Court about a decade ago. Well, the nuclear states haven't lived up to their part of the bargain, and the U.S. is the most extreme. In fact, within a year or so ago, it simply renounced Article 6, said it doesn't apply to us. And it's, meanwhile, has dismantled the other treaties associated with it and is going on to develop new nuclear weapons. But as far as Article 4 is concerned, it made sense in 1970 to permit non-nuclear states to develop nuclear technology. But with the advances in technology in the last years since 1970, the gap between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons has been reduced. So developing nuclear energy leaves you on the verge of a capacity to develop nuclear weapons, and that is a serious problem. And there's an answer to it, and we know the answer. The answer was proposed, for example, by Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the International Agency. A couple of years ago, he proposed that a production of fissile materials, weapons-grade materials, should simply be internationalized, should be under some international authority. If any, not even weapons grade, any fissile materials should be under an international authority. And if some country, say the United States or Iran, wants access to them, they should be able to get access under international supervision. Well, okay, that solves that problem. Only one difficulty. The U.S. wouldn't even look at it. It's dead in the water. In fact, as far as I know, there's only one country in the world that has formally accepted it, Iran. The Iranian head of one of the top ministers, I forget his official name, but he's in charge of the negotiations, announced that, Iran would accept that proposal. And that's a crucial proposal. There's a second one treaty that would ban production, that would cap production of fissile material, so no new ones were finished. That's considered by most nuclear arms specialists as the core of any effort to eliminate nuclear weapons, and that means to save the species from destruction. Well, that's called a FISBAN treaty, ban fissile materials. The Bush administration blocked it for years. Finally, it came to the UN Disarmament Committee in November 2004, and there was a vote. The vote was 174 to 1. You can guess the one. There were two abstentions. Israel abstained, which is reflexive, and more interestingly, Britain abstained. And the British ambassador explained at the session why Britain was abstaining. He said Britain supports this measure, but this particular proposal divisive. It divides the world 174-1, so therefore we can't go along with it. Well, you know, this is probably the most important vote the UN ever had. That literally, the survival of the species depends on it. I don't think there was one single word of coverage in the United States, at least I couldn't find any. It doesn't matter. You know, who cares about the survival of the species? Well, okay, those proposals, the Fisban Treaty and the El Baradei proposal or something like it, they would pretty much solve the problem of the threat of the growing threat of nuclear weapons, and then you can go on to dismantle them as a legal obligation. So that's the general framework. And Iran, so far, happens to be taking the right side. The U.S. is taking the worst position. Let's go more concretely, though. A couple of years ago, there were negotiations between the European Union and Iran on this issue. I mean, nobody wants Iran to get nuclear weapons. That would be terrible. And they have been trying to stop it. And they reached a bargain a couple of years ago. The bargain was that Iran would refrain from its legal right to enrich uranium. It has the right, but it would agree not to do it. And in return, the European Union would provide, I'm now quoting, would provide firm guarantees on security issues. Okay, now everyone knows what security issues means. It means the very well advertised U.S. and Israeli threats and the preparations to attack Iran. That's serious. You know, Iran is a superpower that's been hostile to the Iranian people and for 50 years and to the government for 25 years, and now has major forces on both borders. The regional superpower is its client state, has hundreds of nuclear weapons. Those threats and preparations for action are extremely serious security issues. I mean, the U.S. would never tolerate them for a second. In fact, no country that could would tolerate them. So Iran was calling for firm guarantees on security issues in return for refraining from its legal right to develop nuclear energy. Well, there was a problem with that. The European Union backed down. Under U.S. pressure, they refused to give, or as far as we know, even to consider guarantees on security. After a couple of years of that, Iran began its enrichment programs again. That's where we are now. When all of this is, incidentally, in 2003, I guess it was, Iran and Europe had called for negotiations on security issues. The Bush administration simply refused to take part. Well, okay, you know, nobody wants all sorts of awful things you can say about Iran. Nobody wants them to have nuclear weapons. But there's a little more to the story, and a lot more. And the a lot more, you're not going to read about here.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live on WILL AM 580. We have a full bank of phone callers who I want to turn to now. Before we go to the callers, I want to let our listeners know that tomorrow here in Urbana at the Levis Faculty Center on West Illinois at 4 p.m. there will be a talk by Bill Fletcher on 21st Century Color Lines and Other Lines, The Challenge of Pan-Africanism. That's the Levis Center at 4 p.m. tomorrow, Monday, February 27th. And Bill's a guest on the show and a friend, and it's going to be a terrific talk. I hope to see you all there. And also, callers, if you would be brief, that would be great. We have so there's some noise in the background. Some of you might have heard. This is an unusual experience. Now we have NHK Television from Japan doing a documentary on the growing media reform movement in the United States. It's not covered by our own media, but it's covered by Japanese media. And they've been joining me today for this radio show and some other festivities. So if you hear television crew in the background, that's what it is. On that note, let's go to the phone lines. And I'm going to skip ahead. We have a caller from the Netherlands who's been on hold for about a half hour. So I want to go to that first, then we'll go back to line one. But first, line two, Utrecht, the Netherlands. Welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thanks. Sorry. After the events of September 11th, Mr. Chomsky, you made many insightful speeches about that subject, and that included one called The Emerging Framework of World Power. In that speech, you said that you assumed that Al-Qaeda was, or something very like them, was behind the attacks. And more recently, people like David Ray Griffin, among many others, have brought up startling pieces of information that suggest otherwise. Has your own thinking changed in that regard? And if so, how? I'll take your answer off the webcast.
Yeah.
Right, thank you very much. Yeah, Noam, the 9/11 attacks, the official line and the new revisionist line, where do you stand?
Yeah, there's quite an industry pursuing that line of inquiry, and it's kind of interesting to notice that they're rather welcome to centers of power. So they get a fair amount of publicity. They're, you know, get talks on television. Nobody, you don't get the usual tantrums and hysteria if anyone does something like, say, mention the unspeakable word oil or anything like that. And one certainly wants to know why. And I think you can guess the reasons. One thing is that if you look at the evidence for that, I haven't looked at all of it by any means. For one thing, it's just not a high priority for me, and I'll explain why. But the evidence that I've looked at is the kind of evidence you could put together to show that the White House was bombed yesterday. I mean, if you take any historical event, there's going to be masses of unexplained phenomena. That's why scientists do experiments. Scientists don't take pictures of what's going on outside. You do experiments to try to eliminate the innumerable variables that are contaminating your results and your observations, and see if you can sort of cut things down to an ideal enough situation so you can pick out the major factors. But even with scientific experiments, there's endless numbers of unexplained coincidences, you know, things that are ignored and so on. You read the letters columns in science journals, you see an example. Well, in this case, there are a lot of things, predictably, that are unexplained, funny coincidences and so on. Well, you know, how seriously you want to take that evidence, that's for you to decide. To me, it doesn't look very convincing. But the second point is that the thesis seems to me of such a high level of implausibility that you'd really need overwhelming evidence. I mean, for the Bush administration to have tried anything like that, it would have required something approaching literal insanity. It would have been first of all, what would happen is unpredictable. You never predict what's going to happen in anything as complicated as that. One thing that's fairly predictable is that something would have leaked from the inside. There's a lot of people involved. Chances of keeping a lid on it are pretty slight. If anything leaked, they'd all be lined up before firing squads, and that would be the end of them and the Republican Party forever. Taking a chance like that would have been just outlandish, and there's nothing remotely like it in history. Third point is, I don't really think it's a high priority. There are very obvious crimes, and much more serious, even if it's true. Let's say it's true. They blew up the World Trade Center. Well, okay, that's a crime. But it doesn't weigh very heavily in the balance as compared with other crimes that they're carrying out, including crimes against the American population. So consciously acting in ways that significantly increase the threat of terror, including nuclear terror, and increasing nuclear proliferation, which may doom the species, or, you know, blocking efforts to do something about environmental catastrophe. Now, those are much worse crimes than blowing up the World Trade Center. So even if somebody thinks it's true, and you know, I'm highly skeptical, it's just not a high priority. It diverts attention from much more serious crimes. And my suspicion is that's why it's treated with kid gloves. In fact, you know, there actually are internal government documents on declassification, which urge the government to regularly declassify information and release information on the Kennedy assassination, because it will assuage people's feeling that they've got to find out secrets, and it'll keep them focused on wild goose chases instead of asking hard and serious questions that could be embarrassing. And I suspect someday we're going to discover that that may even be happening here. But in any event, it's simply, at least for me, it's just not a high priority.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Noam Chomsky, with us from his home, I assume, in Lexington, Massachusetts. We are taking callers. We've got a full bank of calls. I'm going to get back to the phone lines in a second. I ask that the callers please be as brief as possible so we can get to everyone. Line one, Urbana, you are the most patient caller in Media Matters history. You've been on the line for 40 minutes. You're on the air now with Noam Chomsky.
Well, thank you, Bob, but I think the caller from the Netherlands was more patient than I. Professor Chomsky, if you would be so kind as to allow me to depart from this burning question of the hour and return to your Harvard G-School debate with Alan Dershowitz. You were accused of standing against the two-state solution of Israel and Palestine. Do you think this could have been a backdoor accusation that you have departed from the traditional position of Hashomer Hatzair, your kibbutz, from a single-state solution of a united, secular, all-Semitic, socialist republic of Israel and Palestine? And then, was the warrior Jew, old man Trotsky, correct in the last instance in his view that a Zionist homeland for the Jews built in Palestine under British imperialist auspices could be nothing but a bloody trap? Thank you for taking my call. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, caller. No?
Well, the claim there that I was opposed to a two-state solution was quite comical. There's a ton of material in print. You can read it. I won't go through it. But since 1974, and there's a reason for the date, I've been one of the few advocates in the country of a two-state solution of the international consent. There is an international consensus on a two-state solution on the international border, pre-June 67 border, recognized almost universally. The first UN Security Council resolution on that was just 30 years ago, January 1976. The U.S. rejected it, vetoed it. And since then, it's been off the agenda. I won't go through the whole record, but just take a look. See if you can find anyone who supports it. Well, you know, I've supported it in print over and over. I don't think it's a good solution. I think it's a bad solution. But of alternatives, it's the best. And it's a stepping stone towards anything better. To go back to the earlier period, in the 1940s, I was never part of Hashomer Hatzair, but I was pretty close to them. And I wasn't part of them because they were either Stalinists or Trotskyists, and I was anti-Leninist, so I could never join them. But I was close in this respect. They didn't call for a one-state solution. They called for a binational solution, which is quite different. I thought that at the time, and still think, that that was a reasonable proposal up until 1948. Well, by 1948, it was moot. There was a state, okay? From then on, the question just didn't arise. It arose again in 1967. In 1967, with the conquest, I began writing again, and you can read it, it's all in print, that now Israel has a chance to institute a much saner solution than a one-state solution, namely it being the dominant state. It could move towards some sort of federation between the occupied territories and Israel. I think that would have been welcome, feasible, and advantageous to both sides. And I continued to think that and to write about it until the October 1973 war, which ended it. After that, by that time, the Palestinian state had entered the international agenda, and it was a strong international consensus, just overwhelming, blocked by the U.S. and Israel, for a two-state settlement. Well, okay, that meant that if you wanted to go on to something like a federation or a binational state, or you would have to go through a first stage. The first stage would have to be a two-state settlement. And that's been my position since 1974 and remains so today. In opposite, since you bring up Alan Dershowitz, he has been one of the most passionate opponents of this. He now claims to favor it, but just take a look at what's in print. He's always been opposed to it, still is. Two-state settlement doesn't mean, you know, Palestinians live in some little corner around Nablus. It means a settlement between two viable states, Palestine and approximately 22% of the territory of Jordan to the sea, and Israel in 78%. And then I would hope they could go on from there to what I seem to be better solutions to me. But at least you have to get that far. However, the U.S. and Israel completely oppose it. And in fact, are not just opposed in words, but are acting in ways to make it impossible. I mean, as we speak, the U.S.-backed Israeli programs to take over the valuable land and resources of the West Bank, partly using this completely illegal and disgraceful separation wall that cuts through the West Bank, to establish salients that break the West Bank into isolated cantons. And recently they finally formally announced what was always obvious, that with U.S. support, as always, they're going to take over the Jordan Valley and slowly expel its inhabitants, which means that whatever cantons are left to the Palestinians would be prisons, essentially pretty much separated from one another in prisons. Then they can call them a state if they want, but you know, it doesn't, it's kind of like South Africa and the Bantustans. If to get back to your original question, I still think, as I did when I was a teenager, that in the 40s, that a long-term solution should be some kind of binational settlement through federation or other arrangements. Works pretty well in many parts of the world. But that has to come in stages. You can't do it by snapping your fingers. And the first step must be to cut down the cycle of violence, to reduce the hatreds, to establish closer relations on other than national grounds, and there are plenty of them. And that means, to begin with, a two-state settlement, and there are concrete proposals. The Geneva Accord, for example, is a serious basis for reaching that. It was reached by informal but high-level Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. It could proceed, except that it's rejected by Israel and dismissed by the United States.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky today in Media Matters. We have a few more callers to go to, and I want to get to all of them. We've only got about 10 minutes left. Just quickly, if I can, though, Noam, to wrap up on this discussion of Israel and Palestine, where do you think matters stand now in the region compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago? I mean, are we closer to an equitable solution, or is it even worse? I mean, what's your sense of where we are historically?
Well, it's been getting worse steadily since the mid-70s. There was a break. In the year 2000 and 2001, which is the one break from total U.S.-Israeli rejectionism, there were steps that could have led somewhere. Not at Camp David. That was hopeless. In fact, Clinton himself conceded that the Camp David proposals wouldn't satisfy minimal Palestinian demands. But there was one week in January 2001. There were formal meetings between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators in Taba, in Egypt. We have a full record of, a very extensive record of it, and plenty of mostly Israeli scholarship about it. And it's pretty clear what happened. They were coming quite close to a sensible agreement. They didn't get there, but they were coming towards a sensible agreement that approximated the international consensus. And at the end of those negotiations, unfortunately, were called off 4 days early by Prime Minister Barak of Israel, so didn't get to the conclusion. But they did release a press conference. They had a press conference after Barak called it off, saying that with a little more time and work, they might be able to get to a settlement. All right, after that, Bush and Sharon took over, and the whole thing was totally out the window. And what happened is just more aggressive steps to make any meaningful solution impossible, not just words, but steps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's been happening now, and now it's about the worst it's ever been.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Now we have some very patient callers. Line 4, Eureka, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Yes, I'd like to know Professor Chomsky's view of the latest, in my opinion, bizarre deal to have one of the, I believe, countries below Saudi Arabia manage seaports. I just heard an inkling this morning from somebody about it. They're an economic relationship between one of Bush's cabinet members and this deal. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. Noam, you've been following this Dubai port issue?
I don't like to be on Bush's side, but I think he has a point here. there are serious security issues at the ports, undoubtedly. I mean, that's been pointed out by high-level government commissions for years, and essentially nothing's being done about them. That's part of the general lack of concern for national security on the part of the Bush administration. It's just not a high priority for them. And one of the failures is failing to do anything serious about these very significant security problems at the ports. Or I suppose the Dubai management takes over. There's no reason that I know to believe that that's going to make the security problems worse. In fact, the security problems are mostly here. And if they're an efficient management, as is claimed, you know, might even make it better. So whether Dubai management runs it, or, you know, Singapore runs it, or Japan runs it, or someone else, as far as I'm aware, it has very little impact on any security issue. Now, I think what the caller said is, I suspect, is exactly right, that lying behind this are intimate relationships between the energy corporations here and, you know, the Bush family's right in the middle of it, and the dictators who run the oil-producing countries. Yeah, sure, that's very likely behind it. But that doesn't follow from that, that security would be hurt by granting them the management, you know, of the ports, which doesn't mean control of security issues. That remains here. And definitely things should be done about it here, but that's been true for years.
Well, I let the record show that we have a position here in support of the Bush administration.
Right.
I think this is another first for Media Matters. We're racking them up today. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Noam Chomsky.
Yes, thank you. I think I'll lighten things up a little bit. I've been reading what you've been up to recently, Professor, and I read that you'd been in Ireland recently. And I don't know if you, this is all tied together. I don't know if you knew this, but in USA Today, they asked, they've got this little thing that they say, well, what are you watching? And Elle McPherson, the supermodel, mentioned that she'd been watching Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky in the media recently, which I think is a good sign. And to tie it all together, I understand people like Edward Wilson says that it's part of our mammalian genetic programming that we, and part of our primate heritage, that we're easily seduced by confident, charismatic leaders. And it was rumored, I understand, that you might have had dinner with Bono while you were in Ireland. So if you did have dinner with him, did he seem like the genuine article to you? Is he a charismatic progressive? And if you didn't...
I did.
Okay. I'd like to know, what's it like being able to travel without a valid passport like the Queen?
I have to tell you that that shot my stock to the stratosphere with my grandchildren. First time I've ever impressed them. My wife was able to get... digital photos of us all together and send them right over the internet. And I can't say over the radio what the response was, but it was ecstatic. There were a lot of people there. I mean, there were Seamus Heaney, Nobel Prize winning poet, and other writers and artists were there too. A lot of interesting people. Dublin's a very exciting place. And Bono was there. In fact, I learned that his name was Bono. I always thought it was Bono. But we did have a little chance to talk, and he struck me as a very serious guy. Knew what he was up to. He understood what positions he was taking and why, and had a reasonable explanation of them and struck me as very genuine and serious. I don't know anything about the music scene, so don't ask me about that, but, except what my grandchildren tell me.
All right, well, let's go to our final caller now for our last couple of minutes. Line 2 for Ina. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Hi, this is absolutely the best use of electronic media, and it's such an honor to be able to talk to such a respected person. And I like you, Noam Chomsky, too. I wish you could make a comment about the reclassification of documents, but the main thing I want to ask and say is how can any sane person live their life knowing that George Bush has his finger on the nuclear trigger? How do we get this guy out of office and the rest of the gangsters? Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Noam?
Well, on the reclassification of documents, that's, of course, a scandal. And, in fact, even the historical profession, pretty conservative profession, regards it as a scandal.
Could you give a little background on that? Because some of our listeners might not be familiar with it.
Well, there is by law, a regular declassification procedure. Technically, it's supposed to be 30 years. It's usually longer than that. There's a group of State Department historians, pretty respectable conservative types, who review declassified records. And if they determine that there's no longer any basis for keeping them secret, they're declassified. And they're published in a big major series, State Department series. And there are other procedures of declassification. So a lot of material gets out. In fact, you know, we're privileged to be in the most free country in the world. That's a real privilege. It wasn't a gift. It was won, but we won it. Our predecessors won it. And one consequence is we know more about the sources of U.S. planning and policy than any other country in the world. A ton of material that's been declassified, and you learn a lot from it. Well, you know, the government power systems don't like that. When you look at the declassified record, you find that not much of it is related to security. Most of it is related to keeping the state secure from its own citizens. They don't want you to know what they're up to. And a large part, I think a large majority, in fact, of what's classified is just kind of like an attack against the citizens to keep power protected. Well, you know, the Bush administration, those guys are not conservatives, anything but. They are radical reactionaries. They believe in a very powerful state, which is highly intrusive in domestic affairs and personal life and international affairs, and is protected from the scrutiny of its citizens, who have no right to know what they're doing. You know, that's kind of quasi-fascist. It's not conservative. And as part of that, they want to prevent declassification. And now, even more, to reverse prior declassification. That is to reclassify documents that were made available. Well, that's consistent, and it has nothing to do with security. So, for example, when they came into office, they prevented, it's a roughly 30-year review period, so the late 60s were supposed to be declassified, and part of what was coming up in the late 60s was the U.S. government support for the restoration of the first overt fascist government in Europe, namely the Greek fascist government. Well, you know, that was under Lyndon Johnson. They don't have any interest in protecting Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats. And there's certainly no security issue involved.
You know, Noam Chomsky, I hate to say this, but I'm going to have to shut us down now because the band's tuning up in the background. Tavis Smiley's coming into the studio. And to my great regret, we have to end the show.
Okay, sorry.
And don't be sorry at all. It's been a wonderful 53 minutes with Noam Chomsky, our guest today on Media Matters. Noam, I hope we can do it again.
Hope so.
Whenever your schedule permits, it's been our honor to have you. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I'll be back in 167 hours. Thank you.
At At the U.S.-Mexican border, the Minutemen wait to stake out illegal immigrants trying to cross the border. They've got call signs and walkie-talkies and guns. But not long after they set up their observation posts, another group shows up to chase the Minutemen around. In the dark of night, in the high desert of California, the chase begins. This and other stories of cat-and-mouse games, plus a new story by David Sedaris set in prison, that's this week on This American Life, tonight at 6 here on AM 580. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the upper 30s and light winds. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s and northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high around 50 degrees and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour.